Conflicted, why arguments are tearing us apart and how they can bring us together. What is the secret of happy relationships? What lies behind some of the greatest scientific and creative breakthroughs? Well, the surprising answer is conflict. Insight and empathy spring from the clash of different perspectives, but in a world where it's easier than ever for people to share their opinions, we should be reaping the benefits of diverse views. The opposite is, in fact, often true. To tell us more about how conflict can help us develop empathy and insight is the author of Conflicted, Ian Leslie. Ian, good morning to you.
Good morning, Josh. Nice to be here.
Good to have you with us. It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, you know, in a world where we have more contact with people from all over the globe with a click of a button, a push of a mouse or whatever, and we should be able to share frank and opposing views, develop an argument, but unfortunately, we seem unable to be able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, the book started because just looking around me, you know, on social media, on Twitter and Facebook and elsewhere, I'm seeing a lot of terrible arguments, just really kind of silly, futile, stupid disagreements that didn't shed any light whatsoever. And then it struck me that actually, we're just not prepared for this world at all. We're not prepared for a world in which everybody has the right to a voice, everybody has an opinion, everybody can speak their mind, and at the click of a button, as you say, they can spread that opinion all around the world. And so we're now constantly kind of seeing other people's terrible opinions paraded before us, and we just get into these silly fights. And the problem is not actually the fights themselves. The problem is because we see these silly fights happening on social media, we become even more averse to disagreement than we were before. Because the fact is, most people are really uncomfortable with disagreeing with other people. And the truth is, we don't get trained in it. Nobody comes along and says, this is how to disagree well. Here's how to disagree well in a way that will lead to insight or truth or a new idea or whatever. And we just do it badly. And so really the book is to help people feel better about disagreeing and help them learn it, almost like a skill.
The thing is, though, you know, we were told that the internet and social media and the World Wide Web were going to turn us into a global village. Instead, it's turned us into a global playground. It's easy to throw an insult, toss an insult, when you're sitting on another continent, you know, behind a computer screen, rather than it would be if you were dealing face-to-face with somebody, and that is perhaps the crux of the problem.
Indeed. So, you know, it's much easier to get into a bad kind of toxic disagreement when, as you say, all you know about that person or all you can see of them in the moment is just a few words in a text box or a GIF or an emoji. When you're face-to-face with someone, you have a very powerful instinctive sense that you have some sort of relationship, if only temporary, that is much more important, much richer than just the thing on which you're disagreeing. Okay, and so that kind of stabilizes the conversation. It means you're able to have more of an interesting conversation, more of an interesting disagreement. When the whole conversation becomes about that little thing about which you're disagreeing, then it's easy to just assume that the person behind those words is just a terrible person and to just dismiss them. And so I think we have to kind of be very wary about getting into disagreements with social media. And when we do it well. But also, you know, the book is only partly about social media. It's about the workplace and about our families and about just getting comfortable with disagreement, because it's got so many benefits. You know, it flushes out what people really think and what they really feel. And so it actually helps us get to know each other. It actually brings us closer together when it's done well.
I mean, I suppose one of the main things then, let's get away from the social media thing, but get into the workplace, if you can get into the workplace, or your family environment. I suppose perhaps one of the most important things about if you're disagreeing with somebody is the art of disagreeing, but at the same time making your point, but at the same time being able to listen to the person you're disagreeing with's point of view.
Yeah, exactly. And just from your description, you can tell how it's like a sort of multi-level skill. you know, it's like sort of three or four dimensional chess. You want to put your point of view across. At the same time, you want to hear the other person's point of view. You also want to see what effect what you're saying is having on them and how they think and feel about you. Because the thing is, in a disagreement, there's always two conversations going on at least. There's the one where the kind of top level one, which is the thing about which you're talking about, whether it's a political issue or maybe you're at home and you're discussing who should take the bins out more. So that's the kind of the surface issue. But there's always this subterranean conversation going on underneath, which is, how do I feel about you and how do you feel about me? And you've got to be attuned to that relationship level if you want the top-level conversation to go well. Okay, so you have to be very alert to how you think that person is feeling about the conversation. And some people are really good at that, and some people are really not. Part of the reason that I talk to a lot of kind of expert people who are expert in conflict-driven conversations. So I talk to interrogators, hostage negotiators, police, addiction therapists, people like this. Now, these people are very attuned to that relationship conversation. They know that they need to strike up a relationship, even if it's with in the case of an interrogator, with a terrorist, you know, or a hostage negotiator, with somebody who's taken hostages. They need to find some sort of relationship before they get into the tough part of the conversation. That's a principle that I think we can apply to all our tough conversations.
Yes, who hasn't amongst listeners been in a family conversation that is akin to a terrorist negotiation? I can hear them saying that. But it's an interesting trick to pull off. So what did you how did you approach people like divorce mediators, diplomats, interrogators, and what sort of what were the I won't tell you the whole book, but what are the top tips, if you like, or the starting points?
Yeah. So the interesting thing is that all these people do very different jobs, right? Divorce mediator has a very, very different job from a hostage negotiator or an interrogator. But actually, when you talk to all of them, you realize that the same principles are at work. And that's really what the book is about. So let's talk about one or two of them. The first one is the one I was just talking about, really, which is called, this is the first rule of productive disagreement in the book, and I call it first connect. So the mistake that a lot of people get in a disagreement is they get straight to the disagreement before they've made any kind of human connection with the person that they're talking to. So, for instance, a hostage negotiator, they are trained to when they pick up the phone and they talk to the person who's taken the hostages or who is in crisis, because often they're just dealing with somebody who's threatening to throw themselves off a building. They're in crisis in some way. They are trained to strike up a connection with them before they get into the negotiation. So they'll say something like, look, I can see that you're handling this situation really well. You've got this under control, and I just want to say all of us here on this side really appreciate the way you've been handling this. And that just has an enormous effect. It just lowers their defenses. It calms them down, makes them feel a little bit less insecure. And then they say, okay, so how are we going to deal with this situation? What do you think? Okay, so you can apply that principle to any kind of disagreement. Before you get to the really tough part of the disagreement, which might be a decision that somebody's taking at work, or it might be a conversation with your child at home, right? Just find some sort of point of where you're letting them know let them see that you respect and you like them, or let them see that there's something that you agree on that's more important than the thing you're about to disagree on. Make that point of connection, then get to the disagreement. So it's a question of sequencing. Do you see what I mean?
So it's not, you don't go in like the proverbial heavy cavalry charge then, scattering them in front. You soften them up a bit by saying, and I think you've done really well to get to this point with taking the bins out, but just that little bit extra, to the end of the street then, basically, rather than going, get the bins out.
Exactly. Now, obviously, if you do it in a way that sounds patently insincere, it's going to backfire. So you have to mean it. And, but you have to find something that you think is actually like the other person is right about or is doing really well, and then you get into the tough bit. Another principle is let go of the rope. And this is something that one of the interrogation experts said to me, he said, the other person will often try and turn this into a battle, over who's right and who's wrong. If you let it become a battle like that, the battle will just go on and on till one of you gets sick and leaves the room. Don't hold on to your point of view, your first position, so tightly. Show that you're prepared to shift a bit, that you're a little bit flexible, that you are actually listening and taking on board what they're saying. That's the only chance you have of getting them to actually listen to you. The reason the most disagreements go badly is that they become power struggles, they become status battles in some way, where everybody's trying to prove that they're the biggest guy in this conversation, they're the strongest one, that they're not weak. Once you get into that kind of dynamic, it's very hard to get out of it. And so the way to avoid that happening is to show a little bit of flexibility, maybe even a little vulnerability yourself, and say, well, I'm not totally sure I'm right about this myself. I might be wrong, but help me out here. Then, you're more likely to have a richer, more interesting disagreement.
So rather than looking at it as a sort of battle of the heavyweight sluggers, a Tyson Fury against whoever, look at it more as perhaps, a Roger Federer on the tennis court, a bit of lob, some topspin, a backhand where you don't surprise it.
That's a really great way of putting it. In fact, one of the other principles in the book is about disrupting the script, because often you get into these conversations where, particularly when it comes to politics and things like that, or kind of familiar domestic arguments, you know the moves in advance. You know that if I say this, they'll say this, and then I'll say this, and then they'll say this. And you're just like, are we really going to go through this again? So mix it up. Yeah, put a bit of top spin on. Introduce a bit of humour. Say something they weren't expected to say. Be incredibly sincere. Be very nice. Just throw in something that's not expected. Throw in that kind of that unexpected lob. And actually, that, again, can kind of get people out of their rut and get the conversation out of its rut and make for a more interesting disagreement.
I've just got this vision of halfway through a particularly tense negotiation just going, oh, nice shoes. But look,
try that. Why not?
Indeed.
Seriously, that kind of thing can sometimes work. It just sort of changes the rhythm of the conversation.
It would have been a fascinating book anyway without the whole science and the interviews, but also you've drawn on some examples of where conflict and argument has in fact come out with some pretty astonishing end results.
So there's so many.
I mean, the invention of the aeroplane, for example. One day we'll be able to fly again, but I mean the invention of the aeroplane, for example.
Yeah, so as your listeners will know, right, the Wright brothers were the kind of the inventors of the first manned flight. And just going back to that story, I knew that as a kind of fact. But what they did was just so phenomenal that it's almost kind of underrated, right? So this is kind of early part of the 20th century. And you had many of the world's top inventors, technologists, scientists, working on this problem of manned flight. And the Wright brothers were the first to solve it. The Wright brothers had no higher education, no institutional qualifications whatsoever. They ran a bike shop, right? These were two brothers who ran a bike shop. But they were kind of amateur obsessives. And they beat the rest of the world to this hugely important invention. And one of the reasons that they got there faster than anyone else was that they were incredibly good at arguing with each other. They were almost obsessive about arguing with each other. If you were walking down the street outside their bike shop, and then you would hear them shouting at each other about the design of a propeller or whatever it was. They woke up in the morning and they'd start arguing about this thing. But they were incredibly close at the same time. So for them, it wasn't a personal thing. They were very close, and so they could argue about the best way to design an aeroplane. And because they argued, they were always making each other's thinking stronger. And that's the great thing about a good argument. You have to think through what you're saying, right? And you point out the weaknesses in the other's argument. They point out the weaknesses in yours. And if it goes well, you get to a much better place much faster. And so it's very kind of key driver of creativity and innovation in general. Really creative, innovative teams disagree with each other very directly, often quite passionately, but because they're all on the same team, it didn't harm their relationship. Just, and the Wright brothers are kind of the ultimate example of that.
And you get, I mean, the history of music, especially rock and roll, is absolutely littered with creative differences. I mean, look at, I mean, to begin with, the Rolling Stones, for example.
Yeah, I mean, the rock group, right, it's almost this brilliant little, like, microcosm of society, or at least of a creative kind of organization. You've got a few individuals, often quite headstrong, or often, you know, very talented, with separate, you know, specialist skills, and they all have to come together and create something bigger than themselves. And they all disagree and fight and fall out a lot. But the ones that do that well tend to be the ones that are successful, and that it doesn't break them up, right? In fact, there was a rock critic who kind of sparked this thought. When he said to me, you know, having watched and been in bands for 30 years, I realized that the bands that are really successful are not the ones who are high-fiving after every gig and hugging themselves and saying, you know, great work, guys. Right? They're the ones who have arguments but manage to do it in a way that doesn't split them up. And the Rolling Stones are the kind of paradigmatic, you know, example of that. You know, we know that Mick and Keith have their differences, and they're very open about those differences, and they are with each other, and they have been with everyone else. But their incredible longevity is down to the fact that they have their arguments out, you know, and just now and again they turn into fights. But different bands do it in different ways. So I talked to the manager of REM, you know, another phenomenally successful band at the top of their game for 20 years or more. And he said, okay, well, they didn't have fights, you know, they weren't kind of passionate, or they didn't have horrible arguments, but what they did was they discussed and disagreed on pretty much every decision that they took. And if one of them was still unhappy at the end of the conversation, they had a veto. So they could say, right, we're not doing this. That was the deal. So they had a little democratic structure in place, and that helped them stick together and do great work for a long time.
I like the way that you said that, you know, the music band is perhaps a micro or a reflection of society with headstrong individuals putting themselves together with their individual talents, and anybody who's playing a group will then go, and then there's the bass player. But anyway, moving swiftly onwards, do you think that perhaps in a culture where we are told that disagreement is wrong, perhaps that we should, you know, disagreeing with somebody is different to just shouting them down, and you have to have an appreciation of the person you disagree with, their influences, their cultural background. So rather than just saying, you know, okay, there are several sides to this story, perhaps it is being able to, as we use the dread word, be empathetic to the other person as well, and not just go in like the proverbial in the china shop.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on something when you said we're uncomfortable with it, right? And really, the whole point of the book is to say we don't have to find it as stressful and as comfortable, as uncomfortable as we seem to find it. I would like us all to just be a little more aware of the benefits of disagreement, and to get to the stage where when somebody disagrees with you, it's not a sign, it's not a slight, it's not a sign that they're attacking you. It's a sign of how much they respect you, right? It's the opposite, right? And you get that in really good teams, whether it's a rock group or a team at work. There's usually a culture where when somebody says, hey, you know what, I think you've got this wrong, you don't think, oh, that's an attack on me, how dare they? You think, wow, okay, this person's taking what I've said seriously and they're going to interrogate it. And maybe they're right. So I'm going to put my case as strongly as I can. But at the end of the day, I'll be prepared to back and move down if they convince me. So that's the kind of the balance that you've got to have in mind. On the one hand, make your case, right? Don't be afraid to speak up and say, this is what I think. On the other hand, keep in one part of your mind, I might be wrong about this. So I'm going to take it as far as I can go until they convince me and I convince myself that they've convinced me that I'm wrong. And you know, either people don't speak up at all, they avoid the disagreement, that's terrible, because then it just becomes passive aggression, or, you know, that eats away at relationships. Or they stick to of what they're saying be way beyond the point at which it's reasonable, and you just get into one of these stupid kind of power struggles. So those are the two mistakes people make, and I want to help people avoid them.
And surely this is a life skill, because unless you are living in an Instagram post, I mean, we don't all run through fields of tulips and white floaty dresses in slow motion in anything that we do. You know, that life is, there are difficult choices to be made, there are different opinions to be made in business or in your personal life, in your relationships, and being open and to these sort of things is a life skill.
It's a life skill, exactly, and it's one that it's a skill that we have to learn and get better at and practice, right? You don't have to have huge rows with your partner or your colleague all the time. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying get comfortable with having disagreements openly. You know, it's not something to be terrified about. One of the most interesting studies that I look in the book is on couples. You know, they used to think in the field of relationship science that couples that avoided argument and conflict and heated disagreements were more likely to stay together and be happy. They now think the opposite. That, you know, having studied it carefully and sort of tracked the progress of couples over years, what they found is that the couples who avoid argument, who never have arguments, always speak to each other nicely and reasonably, are more likely to be unsatisfied, unhappy, and split up than the ones who are actually quite comfortable with having open, blazing rows now and again, right? So, again, you've got to strike a balance. Nobody's saying that a couple that has rows, you know, is rowing all the time is a healthy one. No, that's bad. But couples who are happy tend to be ones who are reasonably comfortable with having rows now and again, right? Not necessarily about huge things, but whatever it is, they'll have it out in the open. Because when you don't have it out in the open, it doesn't go away. It just sort of eats away at the relationship.
It begs the question, now that you've written this book, when your friends have got something particularly sticky coming up, be it a negotiation, a business or something, do they say, oh, hang on a second, I'll get Ian to argue my point for me?
No, but they do come. You see, I'm not really kind of training them in how to win their case, right? That's slightly separate. Well, I mean, it overlaps with that. But I do coach them sometimes on how to have the disagreement in a way that you all, like, move forward, right? So that you all come away thinking, right, that was a really, really good argument or a really good disagreement, and we all learned something from that. And also, you know, just changes slightly the way you think about your own relationships as well. You know, I'm more likely now, having done this research and written the book, to have, you know, open arguments with my wife in front of the children. Right? Not horrible, though. We don't tear strips of each other. But if there's something that we disagree about, I'm more relaxed about having that argument in front of the children rather than going off to some separate room like it's some shameful thing. Because I want the children to grow up thinking, hey, you know, disagreement and argument is a normal, healthy, cool part of life, right? And in fact, it can be quite enjoyable. And I'm sad to say, actually, they've learned that lesson rather too well.
Yes, little negotiators behind your back, as the saying goes. The book is called Conflicted: Why Arguments Are Tearing Us Apart and How They Can Bring Us Together. It's by Ian Leslie. It's out now. The paperback edition came out on the 18th of February. Ian, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, is there social media? Do you have a website? Where can they find you?
Yeah, sure. I have a website, which is ian-leslie.com. My Twitter handle is @MrIanLeslie, so come and find me there, and let's get into a row.
And also, begs the question, I mean, after this one, you conflicted, what one are you, what's your, what, any thoughts for your next book?
No, I've I'm going to take a break from that for a while, get back to me in a few months when the gears start grinding again.
The book is called Conflicted: Why Arguments Are Tearing Us Apart and How They Can Bring Us Together. It's by Ian Leslie. Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you civilly with no arguments this morning.
Absolute pleasure from my side too. Really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.